This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences, and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks, and social phenomena, the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text, theme, or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. Sharat is still on his sabbatical, but we are joined by a very unique guest this week. We have in the studio with us today, Dr. Nasha Broziadi-Khor.
Thank you, Fuad. It's good to see you again.
We're going to talk a bit about ancient Kedah. I think that was what stands out to me about your work. But the more I learn and read about you, the more I find your entire intellectual journey very, very fascinating. Because I think you're the first Malaysian doctorate holder from Pakistan that I've ever met. So let's profile you first before we get into the more academically substantive stuff. So you are an archaeologist.
Yes.
But you were trained in Pakistan. Explain how you got there and how your intellectual maturation happened. Like, what drew you to this field and how did you develop your interest from there?
So I first joined archaeology back in the year 2007. When I did a minor course, we call it, in University of Science Malaysia under the Centre for Global Archaeological Research. Mm-hmm. And after the completion of my bachelor's degree, I pursued my master's in the same university in the study of ancient Kedah. And after I graduated, under the program of the Academic Staff Training Scheme of USM, I've been sent to Pakistan to pursue my PhD in the field of epigraphy and Hindu Buddhist art.
Mm-hmm. And what's epigraphy?
Epigraphy is the field where you study the development of ancient scripts and how to decipher them. Mm-hmm. And for my specialization, I study the scripts of India and the Sanskrit language.
Interesting. Yeah. Now, what was it about that minor class that you took that compelled you, right? Because I think everybody at some point had Googled archaeology and they read about it for 15 minutes. They go, oh, it's very interesting, and then they just leave it there. Or they probably like Google ancient Kedah and they found it, wow, very interesting, and then just left it there. But you pursued it for years and years.
Okay. My bachelor's degree was actually in the field of chemistry.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was a very common field. And I have been interested in the field of archaeology ever since I was a kid. And I think I should pursue a career in archaeology because it is the least studied subject in this country, and I wanted to do something different. Mm-hmm. And when I came to USM, the Center for Global Archaeological Research has been promoting their courses. So I think that I should take a shot, and it happened to work.
Interesting. So, okay, I'm trained before this in philosophy. Now I'm doing cultural studies. I deal largely with texts.
Yeah.
And text, broadly speaking, you have the written word, but also we look at cultural texts, film, music, novels, fashion, and all that. But what are the material that archaeologists deal with? I have in mind just the stereotypes, right? You go to these ancient sites, there are plenty of big sculptures and rocks, and you put some chemicals on it. I mean, is that what it's like, or is it different? Like, can you explain to us what the actual practice is like?
Okay, the study of archaeology involves the discussion about ancient human societies according to the material culture left behind by them. We acquire these material cultures known as artifact through excavations and survey. Okay, for the case of Bujang Valley, the material cultures happen to be ceramics, monuments, sculptures, and from these artifacts we try to elucidate and deduce and to get some insights regarding their society, about their culture, their belief, the way they are living, how they generate the economy. So it is the so we are trying to discuss about the way they live according to what was left behind by them.
I find that gap very huge, you know, because I work in contemporary culture. You know the context, you feel it, you live it in many ways, and you can see the connection, right, between this, say, film and contemporary fashion, this film and contemporary issues. But to retrospectively deduce a piece of ceramic and from there try to imagine what life might have been like seems to me a very big distance.
Because in the study of archaeology, there is no single explanation for an artifact. That's why for the history of Kedah, ancient Kedah, we have so many school of thoughts about it.
Mm.
There are so many different interpretations which contradicts each other.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
that's why different scholar may see the artifacts differently and may give different interpretations.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why in archaeology, our interpretation differs from one to the other. And that's why in order for us to confirm our interpretation, we are doing other approach of analysis, such as scientific analysis. And we will also compare our archaeological material with historical texts, you know, to get a more complete view about the mm-hmm. ancient societies.
You mentioned the scientific method and you mentioned your chemistry background, right?
Yeah.
How much of science is crucial to do good archaeology?
Extremely crucial, because through scientific analysis, we can be able to get the date of the artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
When we get the date, then we can put them into a proper historical context. By doing chemical analysis, we can be able to retrieve information about the provenance of the artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, we can pinpoint where those artifacts came from which society produced those artifacts. And from there, we can be able to deduce more about their history.
Mm-hmm.
So scientific approach is very important in archaeology.
Oh, very yeah. fascinating.
Yes.
I really want to pick your brain on ancient Kedah soon, but for now, I want you to touch a bit about your experience in Pakistan. I think this is the first time in the show too that we've had somebody who've gone through the education system there. Now, why Pakistan, right? You were in USM, just across the waters, kind of stuff that you want to study, but then you took the route to Pakistan instead. So what's the story behind that?
My initial interest of research is the study of pre-Islamic history of Malaysia,
mm-hmm.
of which, of course, pre-Islamic history refers to the period where Hindu, Buddhist cultures and religion predominate in the Southeast Asian archipelago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, in Pakistan, especially in the region of the Northwest, we know that there was a thriving culture, we call it the Gandharan culture, which developed between 1800 BC until 1100 AD.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that region has not been explored properly. And in a way, for me to go there and study those archaeological sites, analyze the sculptures and monuments, can be able to give me a new insight about this period.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, with the knowledge, I can be able to use this kind of experience to analyze my archaeological data in Malaysia.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Can you share a bit about your experience there? Because you mentioned how rare that opportunity is,
yes,
right? But
yes.
I'm guessing it's rare because it's not necessarily the most conducive environment for research. It's a conflict area.
Yes, yes.
I mean, it must have been very challenging for one. I mean, all research is challenging, but this seems to be more of a risk
yes,
than any other researcher would have to take.
Okay. The number one challenge to do research in Pakistan is, of course, the security problems. Of course, we know that in the Northwest Frontier Province, today known as the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, has been plagued by this kind of problem of terrorism, military campaigns against the militants, and archaeological work has been, quite challenging for us. However, for such research to be done in that area, we got lots of support from the local government as well as the local people there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people has been extremely hospitable
mm-hmm.
in spite of the image that in spite of the things that which has been portrayed in the media. But the local people in Peshawar especially has been extremely hospitable. Of course, there are problems here and there.
Of course
there are problems. But, you know, I survived 4 years and I came back in one piece.
But I think you being Malaysian helped.
Yes, and being a Malaysian is extremely helpful because we enjoy a very good reputation in the Islamic world, especially.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think due to my nationality that we managed to do our work properly.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, University Science of Malaysia has sent a team twice in Peshawar to do excavation there. That has not been done yet.
Mm-hmm.
It has been done before, before the problem really started in Peshawar, but we sent our team to Peshawar during a very complicated time.
Mm-hmm.
And we managed to complete the project and it was a great success.
Complicated how?
Complicated as in when we sent the team back in 2014 or 15, if I'm not mistaken, that was the time when the school attack happened, where 160 kids were killed. But we were still doing the excavations there.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so it was a very complicated and volatile times, but mm-hmm. we managed to carry out with the research. So it appears that in spite of this problem, archaeological work continues.
And I sense that it's important to get local community support
of
for
course,
archaeological
certainly.
Because you need to preserve the space, demarcate your area, and this requires that the local community not just recognize your work, but appreciate it to a certain extent, or else you just be intruding and imposing, right?
Surprisingly, the awareness of the locals in Peshawar, in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, appears to be very high. They really appreciate their heritage there, and they know about their past, about the greatness of the Gandhara culture.
That's wonderful.
So we can learn a lot from these people. Mm-hmm. Although they don't have as much infrastructure as they do, but the awareness is very good.
That's fascinating.
Yes.
So, okay, I take it that your training requires knowledge of various languages.
Yes.
Right? So Sanskrit is one of them,
yeah,
presumably. What else?
Okay, in my training, you need to also learn, of course, Sanskrit language, and also the other dialects of the Sanskrit language. Because Sanskrit language is considered to be the official language of India, but it can be divided into many, many other dialects which are not mutually intelligible.
Mm-hmm,
so, for my study in the Gandhara region, we use Prakrit.
Okay.
It is not Sanskrit, it is a version of Sanskrit, we call it Prakrit.
Mm-hmm.
And aside from that, you need to be able to read the Indian scripts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we call it the Harushti script, the Brahmi script,
wow,
and the Sharada script. Most of the inscriptions that are written in those scripts. So before you even register to do your PhD in Pakistan, in this field, you really need to have some knowledge in that, or else they will not approve your proposal.
One of the things I'm picking up here is that archaeology is so deeply interdisciplinary, right? You need to know languages, you need to know culture, you need to know science.
Yes.
You need to probably know some geology as well, right, behind it. So how has that helped your own personal growth?
The field of archaeology, of course, when you need to learn all these things, you must be able to have the skill, in number one, in how to interact with other scholars of these diverse fields. You must be very good in your interpersonal communication skills.
Right.
Secondly, time management. You need to learn everything, and you have to do your research, and at the same time you have to do some literary reading which are less related to your field, but you need to know. And thirdly, you must know how to coordinate your work with other different agencies, government agencies and research institutes. So these three things are very important.
Yeah. You need to have a lot of street smarts as well, right? Because you're dealing with people who are not necessarily academics, right? And you have to explain the value of your work. And I'm thinking, of course, the stereotypes in Indiana Jones or something. I know you probably did it, like have street battles or gunshot wounds or whatever. I don't know, maybe you haven't told us. But, you know, I'm thinking, because from my kind of research, it's far more exotic and exciting,
So you really need to mingle with the public also in Peshawar, because most of the archaeological sites are located in the village areas. You know, it is located in the settlement area. So, of course, you need to have very good relation with the local people. You know, you need the support. You need them to guide you around into the archaeological. Sometimes the site are located within the compound of other people's house.
Wow.
Yep. So you need to you must be able to communicate your intention properly to the people so that they can give you access to the sites. And in the region where I was working on, and that would also determine whether you are going to survive that research. Yes, you must be able to engage the people properly, and you must mingle properly with the local people.
Is there ever enough time? Because there's so much that is just waiting to be discovered, and you only really had 4 years.
Okay, you see, archaeological research in Peshawar has started since the 18th century, when the British first arrived. And until now, so many questions has not been settled yet. It is not going to happen in a single lifetime to finish the research.
Fascinating. All right. Thank you so much, Nasha. I mean, it's great to profile you, because I think just knowing about your intellectual development has taught me a lot about the world in general. Let's take a break. We'll come back for the second part of the show, where we'll talk a lot more about ancient Kedah and how we can look at it from a contemporary lens. This is Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, joined this week by Dr. Nasha bin Raziadi Khor, an archaeologist at the University of Science Malaysia in Penang. And you're listening to Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, joined this week by Dr. Nasha bin Raziadi Khor, an archaeologist at USM Penang. And we are going to talk more about ancient Kedah in this part of the show. But just before this, during the first half, we really profiled, I think, your background, and I got to know what an archaeologist does and the field of archaeology in general and its intellectual demands. But let's start with the most public and well-known topic of archaeology in Malaysia, which is ancient Kedah. What drew you into this topic in particular? I know you mentioned like your fascination with archaeology as a field, but ancient Kedah, I think because you're from Penang as well, probably resonates to you on a more personal level, right? So tell us a bit about that.
Okay, first of all, we need to properly define what is ancient Kedah. Okay, so we have to know that ancient Kedah was a seaport, as well as a form of a kingdom, which consists of collections of various settlements aggregated together, which are located in the ancient coastline and river valleys of the present-day Bujang Valley, Kedah. So the area of Bujang Valley is defined as the area covering the slopes of the northern part of Gunung Jerai until the Muda River in the south.
Mm.
Okay? And being a seaport, ancient Kedah was the place where traders stopped by either to trade, replenish their ships, or to wait for a monsoonal change before continuing with their journey. Now, why am I interested in this Kedah? The ancient Kedah became one of my many research interests due to its role in the historical framework of Southeast Asia, particularly in explaining the extent of Indian, Chinese and Middle Eastern trade in the region.
Okay, so what era is this?
There has been intense debate about this, but it has been generally accepted that Kedah started to make its appearance between the 2nd century AD until the 14th century AD.
Mm-hmm.
Between this period.
So it's a long period of prominence.
Yeah. It was a very long period of prominence between around 1,200 years. And even before the 2nd century AD, we have discovered a good number of iron smelting sites, which shows that before the port was established, there was already an iron industry in the area.
Interesting.
Yes.
So it's considered, quote-unquote, I don't know if this is the right word, developed for an ancient civilization.
Yes, and prior to its appearance as an entry port, there was also, how do we say, a prehistoric society there, which developed between the 3000 BC until the 600 BC.
Mm-hmm.
There was already an ancient society, and as the Indian traders and the Chinese traders started to appear in the region, due to their interaction in terms of trade and culture, the port started to develop to become a political entity and a cultural entity.
Can you describe the cultural landscape here? What was the language that was used? What were the beliefs that were held at that time? And how was the coexistence maintained, right? Because like you said, you mentioned Chinese, Arabic and Middle Eastern influences kind of coming together.
Yes. Okay. There is one big problem regarding the interpretation regarding Kedah. We have enough evidence, archaeological, historical evidence, to say that the port was very important. We have enough commodities which was discovered there, ceramics, beads, all sorts of things. But it is very difficult for us to pinpoint the kind of culture which was being practiced there or the kind of languages which was being used. However, to our best guess, it could have been Austronesian languages, which was spoken there. And the local people could have practiced their own local cultures, you know, having animistic beliefs probably, with certain amount of influence of Hindu and Buddhism, according to the discovery of Hindu temples and Hindu sculptures. There could have been some influence of Hinduism and Buddhism, but to what extent, we are not sure about that yet.
Besides it being somewhat faced or thought about in the kind of Malaysian context, right, so-called Malaysian, I guess now, was this recognized in other histories? I mean, is ancient Kedah recognized in Thai history, Chinese history? How was its regional impact felt?
Okay. The position of Kedah in the framework of Southeast Asian history can be seen from the various Arabic, Indian and Chinese texts, and as well as a number of inscriptions discovered in India. Okay. For the first time, Kedah was mentioned in the Indian text Pattinapalai in the 2nd century BC. It mentioned that the port of Kedah was very important, which produced lots of iron. That is consistent with this discovery of iron smelting sites in Sungai Batu. And then, as far as politics is concerned, Kedah used to be within the empire of Sriwijaya, which was mentioned inside the Indian text also, because the king of Sriwijaya was mentioned as the king of Kedah.
I see.
So it was part of the ancient Sriwijayan kingdom, which was located in the Sumatra island. As far as culture is concerned, we have discovered a good number of Buddhist sculptures, Hindu sculptures and numerous Hindu and Buddhist temples, as well as secular sites. However, it is very difficult for us to determine the artistic form of these findings, as analyses are still being done right now. So it is, the research is still ongoing.
Is there any idea on the fall of ancient Kedah, because it was so prominent? What happened?
We, according to our research, it shows that the fall of ancient Kedah happened somewhere between the end of 14th century CE until the 15th century CE, due to several factors. The first factor is due to the changing of climate and the sea level. Ancient Kedah was a port. When the sea level started to drop, then the ship cannot be able to harbour near to the coastline. And as a result, the economy fell.
I see.
The economy fell, the port ceased to exist. Secondly, it is due to the political condition in the 14th century, where there was continuous fights between the Majapahit Empire, the infighting in the Majapahit Empire, as well as the invasion of the Thais from the north. So due to such political uncertainty, the trade also fell. So due to these factors, then Kedah started to lose its prominence and it became a small hamlet for paddy planting.
So it was a long fall too, I think. It took a long time, because strong empires, right? Typically there's an internal dissension that happens and that leads to a slow degeneration. Unfortunately, this issue requires a lot more scholarly insight, right? Because at the popular level, it's been so grossly politicized. People read this as some kind of forgotten history of a pre-Islamic Malaya. Some see it as an attempt to marginalize sort of our more animistic Hindu identity. What do you make of contemporary popular accounts of this?
Okay, this is the story about Kedah, especially regarding the nature of religion, the nature of the ethnicity of the ancient Kedah, has already been intensely researched and published for the first 100 years. The problem is that the public were not looking for these materials and read it. The materials are available everywhere, in the libraries, even in the internet. So they simply have to go and search for it. There is no question about this. I mean, it has been clear that the local populations was local. They have lots of foreign traders living together with them, which imply multiculturalism and cosmopolitan form of society then. So I don't think that this issue should ever be politicized, you know, because there's no room for politicizing these issues. It was clear inside our research. So people should read more and get more awareness from these readings.
There is a sense though that Lembah Bujang in particular has been neglected, that a lot of the material that made this world has somehow been relocated and now it's just fragments left. People read that as a sign of neglect and oversight. What do you make of that?
Okay, for the sites in Bujang Valley, it has been properly preserved, especially under the care of the Malaysian Heritage Department and as well as under the state government. Of course, several sites were located on private lands and it is a bit difficult to maintain those sites. But as far as the sites which was within the control of this government institution, they are being well taken off, especially in the Sungai Batu archaeological sites. So we preserve those sites very nicely, and as well as the artifacts which are in the museum, so they are being displayed and nicely preserved. So of course, for the new discoveries also, we, there are ways to conserve the sites in situ conservation. The sites are being properly preserved as far as the institutions, as far as the site which under the care of the government institutions.
What is the contemporary relevance of all this history, right? Because on one hand, it's fascinating to know. We get to know the peninsula in richer ways. But is this just all historical curiosity, or do you find insights that can be useful for today?
Okay, there is no doubt that our study on ancient Kedah will contribute to our understanding of our current national identity. And we have lots in common with the ancient societies in Kedah. From our archaeological research there, from our historical research, we know that aside from the native population, we have the Indians, the Chinese, the Arabs living together in the same area to trade for the economic interests, you know, for the, while waiting for a monsoonal change, while, you know, before they can move on with their journey. So these people were living together, probably harmoniously, and trading with each other. And it appears that these people were living in a cosmopolitan area with multiculturalism, and we also discovered some monuments, Hindu monument and Buddhist monument, located next to each other. So of course we it shows that there were multicultural makeup over there, and today we are having the same thing. So it appears that multiculturalism is not something very recent.
It's part of the peninsula's identity.
Parts of the peninsula identity. It is because the peninsula is located between China and India. Mm-hmm. And these people would naturally pass by and stop by also. So of course, from our study in Bhujangvidhi, it shows that even during ancient times, well, when people were less civilized, they can be able to tolerate each other. Why not now?
Interesting. These days, I hear a lot of complaints about universities scaling down on spending. They're not very supportive with research that are in the humanities or in the arts. Do you find that to be the case in archaeology here?
No. Certainly not. Because our research in Bhujangvidhi has been intensely supported by the university as well as by the federal government and the state government also. Mm. This is a very important research because the research on Bhujangvidhi creates our identity. It shows that even prior to the rise of the Malaccan Sultanate, we already have our own culture, our own form of statehood, you know, during that time. So of course, we are getting lots of support for this research.
Okay. So what are the major questions in the discourse now?
Regarding the discussion about ancient Kedah, can be divided into five main parts. Number one is the economic structure. Number two, the political structure. Number three, the religious belief. Number four, the art. And number five, the chronology. As far as the economic structure, almost all scholars agree about the importance of trade in the development of Kedah. However, the nature of the archaeological discovery in Kedah made the insight of political and the other four very scanty. You know, there is no single interpretation about this, the political, cultural, religious and chronological structure of Kedah. So lots of people are still debating on it. You know, for instance, for the political structure, some people believe that Kedah was an independent kingdom. Some believe that it was part of a bigger empire. Some believe that it has a Hindu-Buddhist form of kingdom. Some say that it is just some normal chiefdoms. So there is no way for us to be sure about it until we find new discoveries. As far as religion is concerned, some believe that the people were intensely Hindu-Buddhist. Some believe that they are not Hindu, even Hindu-Buddhist, but believing in this pagan religion, or we call it animistic religion. There's no way of being sure until we have new discoveries.
So more research needs to be done.
More research needs to be done, yep.
Is archaeology growing in popularity in any way in Malaysia? Or do you find it just circulating among a small circle of academics?
Well, nowadays, since the discovery of the Sungai Batu archaeological site, it appears that the public are more interested in the site. We receive thousands of visitors every month in our Sungai Batu site. And the University of Science of Malaysia are trying our best to outreach, you know, to have an outreach program to create more awareness among the public regarding the importance of history and archaeology, and how does history and archaeology can contribute to building their national identity.
Yeah, I mean, my sense is that you can't do history without archaeology.
Exactly.
I mean, that's sort of the foundation, right? Because you need to know what's the stuff that you want to talk about, right? I mean, it's not really a popular major. Typically in universities, it's not the first kind of thing they think about, you know. So, but based on what you shared here, it's quite adventurous. I mean, that's the word I hear, you know, it's the more adventurous side of academia. Because you mentioned how archaeology is so multifaceted, right? It's so interdisciplinary. That can be a daunting factor for somebody who wants to start as well, right? Because yes, it's interesting, but I gotta know so much stuff. And this can be discouraging, right? What do you say to that?
Well, you know, you really need to start from somewhere, you know. But in order for beginners to really start learning about archaeology, it is good that they can start from reading the old literatures, you know, written by the scholars. And then from there, you can branch out to which part of archaeology that you wanted to learn. But there are always some introductory books on this. And there are plenty of them available.
Typically, as we wrap up, we want recommendations, right? So what are the texts, books, articles, films or websites that our listeners can go to find out more about the stuff you've been sharing?
Okay, on Bhujangvidhi, you can simply go to YouTube and you can just type Bhujangvidhi, and there are lots of videos about it, especially those made by our department.
Oh, wow, great.
Yes, and also we have a number of publications published by USM Press regarding Bhujangvidhi, and also by University Kebangsaan of Malaysia, especially by Professor Datuk Dr. Nick Hassan Suhaimi, by Dr. Zul Iskandar Ramli. So those are the other scholars who are also contributing a lot to our study in Bhujangvidhi. Aside from USM, we have the University Kebangsaan and University Melaya who are also doing the same kind of research. Of course, with slightly different interpretations, but all contribute to the same thing, to understanding the history of Bhujangvidhi.
Wonderful, wonderful. So are you on social media?
Yes, quite a lot.
Okay. So you're on Facebook,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so people can look you up. You don't mind that, right?
No, not
And
all.
Are you on Twitter or Instagram?
On Instagram, yes.
Okay.
Right, on Twitter. Yes.
What's your handle on Instagram?
My Instagram is Nashako.
Nashako. Okay, yeah. Great. So if you want to know more about Nasha's work and writings and other updates, you can look him up on those platforms. Thank you so much for joining us, Nasha.
You're most welcome.
I really appreciate it. I learned a lot. And once again, you can always email the show. That's at bfmnightschool@gmail.com or look us up on Facebook. Just type BFM Night School on the search space and you'll find our page. Be sure to like it. Once again, you're listening to Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.